blink. Men in that milieu cultivate a hair trigger for violent retaliation, not just against rulers, but against anyone who would test their resolve by signs of disrespect that could reveal them to be easy pickings for rustlers, Scottish Highlanders, Appalachian mountain men, Western cowboys, Maasai warriors, Sioux Indians, Druze and Bedouin tribesmen, Balkan clansmen, and Indo-Chinese Montagnards are familiar examples. A man's honor is a kind of social reality in John Searle's sense. It exists because everyone agrees it exists, but it is no less real for that, since it resides in a shared granting of power. When the lifestyle of a people changes, their culture of honor can stay with them for a long time, because it is difficult for anyone to be the first to renounce the culture. The very act of renouncing it can be a concession of weakness and low status, even when the sheep and mountains are a distant memory. The American South has long had higher rates of violence than the North, including a tradition of dueling among men of honor, such as Andrew Jackson. Nisbet and Cohen note that much of the South was originally settled by Scottish and Irish herdsmen, whereas the North was settled by English farmers. Also, for much of its history, the mountainous frontier of the South was beyond the reach of the law. The resulting Southern culture of honor is, remarkably, alive at the turn of the 21st century in laws and social attitudes. Southern states place fewer restrictions on gun ownership, allow people to shoot an assailant or burglar without having to retreat first, are tolerant of spanking by parents and corporal punishment by schools, are more hawkish on issues of national defense, and execute more of their criminals. These attitudes do not float in a cloud called culture, but are visible in the psychology of individual Southerners. Nisbet and Cohen advertised a fake psychology experiment at the Liberal University of Michigan. To get to the lab, respondents had to squeeze by a stooge who was filing papers in a hallway. As a respondent brushed past him, the stooge slammed the drawer shut and muttered, "Asshole." Students from northern states laughed him off, but students from southern states were visibly upset. The southerners had elevated levels of testosterone and cortisol, a stress hormone, and reported lower levels of self-esteem. They compensated by giving a firmer handshake and acting more dominant toward the experimenter, and on the way out of the lab they refused to back down when another stooge approached in a narrow hallway, and one of the two had to step aside. It's not that Southerners walk around chronically fuming. A control group who had not been insulted were as cool and collected as the Northerners. And Southerners do not approve of violence in the abstract, only of violence provoked by an insult or trespass. African-American inner-city neighborhoods are among the more conspicuously violent environments in Western democracies, and they too have an entrenched culture of honor. In his insightful essay, The Code of the Streets, the sociologist Elijah Anderson describes the young men's obsession with respect, their cultivation of a reputation for toughness, their willingness to engage in violent retaliation for any slight, and their universal acknowledgement of the rules of this code. Were it not for giveaways in their dialect, such as, "If someone disses you, you got to straighten them out," Anderson's description of the code would be indistinguishable from accounts of the culture of honor among white Southerners. Inner-city African Americans were never goat herds, so why did they develop a culture of honor? One possibility is that they brought it with them from the South when they migrated to large cities after the two world wars. A nice irony for Southern racists who would blame inner-city violence on something distinctively African American. Another factor is that the young man's wealth is easily stealable, since it is often in the form of cash or drugs. A third is that the ghettos are a kind of frontier in which police protection is unreliable. The gangster rap group Public Enemy has a recording called 911 is a Joke. A fourth is that poor people, especially young men, cannot take pride in a prestigious job, a nice house, or professional accomplishments. And this may be doubly true for African Americans after centuries of slavery and discrimination. Their reputation on the streets is their only claim to status. Finally, Anderson points out that the code of the streets is self-perpetuating. A majority of African-American families in the inner city subscribe to peaceable middle-class values they refer to as decent. But that is not enough to end the culture of honor. Everybody knows that if the rules are violated, there are penalties. Knowledge of the code is thus largely defensive. It is literally necessary for operating in public. Therefore, even though families with a decency orientation are usually opposed to the values of the code, they often reluctantly encourage their children's familiarity with it to enable them to negotiate the inner-city environment. Studies of the dynamics of ghetto violence are consistent with Anderson's analysis. The jump in American urban crime rates between 1985 and 1993 can be tied in part to the appearance of crack cocaine and the underground economy it spawned. As the economist Jeff Groger points out, violence is a way to enforce property rights in the absence of legal recourse. The emergence of violence within the new drug economy then set off the expected Hobbesian trap. As the criminologist Jeffrey Fagan noted, gun use spread contagiously as young people who otherwise wouldn't carry guns felt that they had to in order to avoid being victimized by their peers. And as we saw in the chapter on politics, conspicuous economic inequality is a good predictor of violence, better than poverty itself. Presumably because men deprived of legitimate means of acquiring status compete for status on the streets instead. It is not surprising, then, that when African-American teenagers are taken out of underclass neighborhoods, they are no more violent or delinquent than white teenagers. Hobbes's analysis of the causes of violence, borne out by modern data on crime and war, shows that violence is not a primitive, irrational urge, nor is it a pathology, except in the metaphorical sense of a condition that everyone would like to eliminate. Instead, it is a near inevitable outcome of the dynamics of self-interested, rational social organisms. But Hobbes is famous for presenting not just the causes of violence, but a means of preventing it. A common power to keep them all in awe. His commonwealth was a means of implementing the principle that a man be willing, when others are so too, to lay down his right to all things and be contented with so much liberty against other men as he would allow other men against himself. People vest authority in a sovereign person or assembly who can use the collective force of the contractors to hold each one to the agreement because covenants without the sword are but words, and of no strength to secure a man at all. A governing body that has been granted a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence can neutralize each of Hobbes's reasons for quarrel. By inflicting penalties on aggressors, the governing body eliminates the profitability of invading for gain. That, in turn, diffuses the Hobbesian trap, in which mutually distrustful peoples are each tempted to inflict a preemptive strike to avoid being invaded for gain. And a system of laws that defines infractions and penalties and meets them out disinterestedly can obviate the need for a hair trigger for retaliation and the accompanying culture of honor. People can rest assured that someone else will impose disincentives on their enemies, making it unnecessary for them to maintain a belligerent stance to prove they are not punching bags. And having a third party measure the infractions and the punishments circumvents the hazard of self-deception, which ordinarily convinces those on each side that they have suffered the greater number of offenses. These advantages of third-party intercession can also come from non-governmental methods of conflict resolution, in which mediators try to help the hostile parties negotiate an agreement, or arbitrators render a verdict but cannot enforce it. The problem with these toothless measures is that the parties can always walk away when the outcome doesn't come out the way they want. Adjudication by an armed authority appears to be the most effective general violence reduction technique ever invented. Though we debate whether tweaks in criminal policy, such as executing murderers versus locking them up for life, can reduce violence by a few percentage points, there can be no debate on the massive effects of having a criminal justice system as opposed to living in anarchy. The shockingly high homicide rates of pre-state societies, with 10 to 60% of the men dying at the hands of other men, provide one kind of evidence. Another is the emergence of a violent culture of honor in just about any corner of the world that is beyond the reach of the law. Many historians argue that people acquiesced to centralized authorities during the Middle Ages and other periods to relieve themselves of the burden of having to retaliate against those who would harm them and their kin. And the growth of those authorities may explain the hundredfold decline in homicide rates in European societies since the Middle Ages. The United States saw a dramatic reduction in urban crime rates from the first half of the 19th century to the second half, which coincided with the formation of professional police forces in the cities. The causes of the decline in American crime in the 1990s are controversial and probably multifarious, but many criminologists trace it in part to more intensive community policing and higher incarceration rates of violent criminals. The inverse is true as well. When law enforcement vanishes, all manner of violence breaks out. Looting, settling old scores, ethnic cleansing, and petty warfare among gangs, warlords, and mafias. This was obvious in the remnants of Yugoslavia, the Soviet Union, and parts of Africa in the 1990s, but can also happen in countries with a long tradition of civility. As a young teenager in proudly peaceable Canada during the romantic 1960s, I was a true believer in Bakunin's anarchism. I laughed off my parents' argument that if the government ever laid down its arms, all hell would break loose. Our competing predictions were put to the test at 8 o'clock a.m. on October 17, 1969, when the Montreal police went on strike. By 11:20 a.m., the first bank was robbed. By noon, most downtown stores had closed because of looting. Within a few more hours, taxi drivers burned down the garage of a limousine service that had competed with them for airport customers. A rooftop sniper killed a provincial police officer. Rioters broke into several hotels and restaurants, and a doctor slew a burglar in his suburban home. By the end of the day, 6 banks had been robbed, 100 shops had been looted, 12 fires had been set, 40 carloads of storefront glass had been broken, and $3 million in property damage had been inflicted before city authorities had to call in the army and, of course, the Mounties to restore order. This decisive empirical test left my politics in tatters and offered a foretaste of life as a scientist. The generalization that anarchy in the sense of a lack of government leads to anarchy in the sense of violent chaos may seem banal, but it is often overlooked in today's still romantic climate. Government in general is anathema to many conservatives, and the police and prison system are anathema to many liberals. Many people on the left, citing uncertainty about the deterrent value of capital punishment compared to life imprisonment, maintain that deterrence is not effective in general. And many oppose more effective policing of inner-city neighborhoods, even though it may be the most effective way for their decent inhabitants to abjure the code of the streets. Certainly, we must combat the racial inequities that put too many African-American men in prison. But as the legal scholar Randall Kennedy has argued, we must also combat the racial inequities that leave too many African-Americans exposed to criminals. Many on the right oppose decriminalizing drugs, prostitution, and gambling without factoring in the costs of the zones of anarchy that, by their own free market logic, are inevitably spawned by prohibition policies. When demand for a commodity is high, suppliers will materialize, and if they cannot protect their property rights by calling the police, they will do so with a violent culture of honor. This is distinct from the moral argument that our current drug policies incarcerate multitudes of nonviolent people. Schoolchildren are currently fed the disinformation that Native Americans and other peoples in pre-state societies were inherently peaceable, leaving them uncomprehending, indeed contemptuous, of one of our species' greatest inventions, democratic government and the rule of law. Where Hobbes fell short was in dealing with the problem of policing the police. In his view, civil war was such a calamity that any government, monarchy, aristocracy, or democracy, was preferable to it. He did not seem to appreciate that in practice a Leviathan would not be an otherworldly sea monster, but a human being or group of them, complete with the deadly sins of greed, mistrust, and honor. As we saw in the preceding chapter, this became the obsession of the heirs of Hobbes who framed the American Constitution. Armed men are always a menace, so people who are not under tight democratic control can be a far worse calamity than the crime and feuding that go on without them. In the 20th century, according to the political scientist R.J. Rummel in Death by Government, 170 million people were killed by their own governments. Nor is murder by government a relic of the tyrannies of the middle of the century. The World Conflict List for the year 2000 reported, "The stupidest conflict in this year's count is Cameroon. Early in the year, Cameroon was experiencing widespread problems with violent crime. The government responded to this crisis by creating and arming militias and paramilitary groups to stamp out the crime extrajudicially. Now, while violent crime has fallen, the militias and paramilitaries have created far more chaos and death than crime ever would have. Indeed, as the year wore on, mass graves were discovered that were tied to the paramilitary groups." The pattern is familiar from other regions of the world, including our own, and shows that civil libertarians' concern about abusive police practices is an indispensable counterweight to the monopoly on violence we grant the state. Democratic leviathans have proven to be an effective anti-violence measure, but they leave much to be desired. Because they fight violence with violence or the threat of violence, they can be a danger themselves. And it would be far better if we could find a way to get people to abjure violence to begin with, rather than punishing them after the fact. Worst of all, no one has yet figured out how to set up a worldwide democratic leviathan that would penalize the aggressive competition, defuse the Hobbesian traps, and eliminate the cultures of honor that hold between the most dangerous perpetrators of violence of all, nation-states. As Kant noted, "The depravity of human nature is displayed without disguise in the unrestricted relations which obtain between the various nations." The great question is how to get people and nations to repudiate violence from the start, preempting escalations of hostility before they can take off. In the 1960s, it all seemed so simple. War is unhealthy for children and other living things. What if they gave a war and nobody came? War, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. The problem with these sentiments is that the other side has to feel the same way at the same time. In 1939, Neville Chamberlain offered his own anti-war slogan, "Peace in Our Time." It was followed by a world war and a Holocaust because his adversary did not agree that war is good for absolutely nothing. Chamberlain's successor, Churchill, explained why peace is not a simple matter of unilateral pacifism. Nothing is worse than war. Dishonor is worse than war. Slavery is worse than war. A popular bumper sticker captures a related sentiment. If you want peace, work for justice. The problem is that what one side sees as honor and justice, the other side may see as dishonor and injustice. Also, honor can be a laudable willingness to defend life and liberty, but it can also be a reckless refusal to de-escalate. Sometimes, all sides really do see that they would be better off beating their swords into plowshares. Scholars such as John Keegan and Donald Horowitz have noted a general decline in the taste for violence as a means of settling disputes within most Western democracies in the last half century. Civil wars, corporal and capital punishment, deadly ethnic riots, and foreign wars requiring face-to-face killing have declined or vanished. And as I have mentioned, though some decades in recent centuries have been more violent than others, the overall trend in crime has been downward. One possible reason is the cosmopolitan forces that work to expand people's moral circle. Another may be the long-term effects of living with a Leviathan. Today's civility in Europe, after all, followed centuries of beheadings and public hangings and exiles to penal colonies, And Canada may be more peaceable than its neighbor, in part because its government outraced its people to the land. Unlike the United States, where settlers fanned out over a vast two-dimensional landscape with innumerable nooks and crannies, the habitable portion of Canada is a one-dimensional ribbon along the American border, without remote frontiers and enclaves in which cultures of honor could fester. According to the Canadian studies scholar Desmond Morton, our West expanded in an orderly, peaceful fashion, with the police arriving before the settlers. But people can become less truculent without the external incentives of dollars and cents or governmental brute force. People all over the world have reflected on the futility of violence, at least when they are evenly enough matched with their adversaries that no one can prevail. A New Guinean native laments, "War is bad and nobody likes it. Sweet potatoes disappear, pigs disappear, fields deteriorate, and many relatives and friends get killed. But one cannot help it." Chagnon reports that some Yanomamo men reflect on the futility of their feuds, and a few make it known that they will have nothing to do with raiding. In such cases, it can become clear that both sides would come out ahead by splitting the differences between them, rather than continuing to fight over them. During the trench warfare of World War I, weary British and German soldiers would probe each other's hostile intent with momentary respites in shelling. If the other side responded with a respite in kind, long periods of unofficial peace broke out beneath the notice of their bellicose commanders. As a British soldier said, "We don't want to kill you, and you don't want to kill us, so why shoot?" The most consequential episode in which belligerents sought a way to release their deadly embrace was the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, when the United States discovered Soviet nuclear missiles in Cuba and demanded that they be removed. Khrushchev and Kennedy were both reminded of the human costs of the nuclear brink they were approaching. Khrushchev by memories of two world wars fought on his soil. Kennedy by a graphic briefing of the aftermath of an atomic bomb. And each understood they were in a Hobbesian trap. Kennedy had just read The Guns of August and saw how the leaders of great nations could blunder into a pointless war. Khrushchev wrote to Kennedy, "You and I should not now pull on the ends of the rope in which you have tied a knot of war, because the harder you and I pull, the tighter this knot will become. And a time may come when this knot is tied so tight that the person who tied it is no longer capable of untying it, and then the knot will have to be cut." By identifying the trap, they could formulate a shared goal of escaping it. In the teeth of opposition from many of their advisors and large sectors of their publics, both made concessions that averted a catastrophe. The problem with violence, then, is that the advantages of deploying it or renouncing it depend on what the other side does. Such scenarios are the province of game theory, and game theorists have shown that the best decision for each player individually is sometimes the worst decision for both collectively. The most famous example is the prisoner's dilemma, in which partners in crime are held in separate cells. Each is promised freedom if he is the first to implicate his partner, who then will get a harsh sentence, a light sentence if neither implicates the other, and a moderate sentence if each implicates the other. The optimal strategy for each prisoner is to defect from their partnership. But when both do so, they end up with a worse outcome than if each stayed loyal. Yet neither can stay loyal out of fear that his partner might defect and leave him with the worst outcome of all. The prisoner's dilemma is similar to the pacifist's dilemma. What is good for one, belligerence, is bad for both. But what is good for both, pacifism, is unattainable when neither can be sure the other is opting for it. The only way to win a prisoner's dilemma is to change the rules or find a way out of the game. The World War I soldiers changed the rules in a way that has been much discussed in evolutionary psychology. Play it repeatedly and apply a strategy of reciprocity, remembering the other player's last action and repaying him in kind. But in many antagonistic encounters, that is not an option, because when the other player defects, he can destroy you, or, in the case of the Cuban Missile Crisis, destroy the world. In that case, the players had to recognize they were in a futile game and mutually decide to get out of it. Glover draws an important conclusion about how the cognitive component of human nature might allow us to reduce violence, even when it appears to be a rational strategy at the time. Sometimes, apparently rational, self-interested strategies turn out, as in the prisoner's dilemma, to be self-defeating. This may look like a defeat for rationality, but it is not. Rationality is saved by its own open-endedness. If a strategy of following accepted rules of rationality is sometimes self-defeating, this is not the end. We revise the rules to take account of this, so producing a higher-order rational strategy. This in turn may fail, but again we go up a level. At whatever level we fail, there is always the process of standing back and going up a further level. The process of standing back and going up a further level might be necessary to overcome the emotional impediments to peace as well as the intellectual ones. Diplomatic peacemakers try to hurry along the epiphanies that prompt adversaries to extricate themselves from a deadly game. They try to blunt competition by carefully fashioning compromises over the disputed resources. They try to defuse Hobbesian traps via confidence-building measures, such as making military activities transparent and bringing in third parties as guarantors. And they try to bring the two sides into each other's moral circles by facilitating trade, cultural exchanges, and people-to-people activities. This is fine as far as it goes, but the diplomats are sometimes frustrated that at the end of the day the two sides seem to hate each other as much as they did at the beginning. They continue to demonize their opponents, warp the facts, and denounce the conciliators on their own side as traitors. Milton J. Wilkinson, a diplomat who failed to get the Greeks and Turks to bury the hatchet over Cyprus, suggests that peacemakers must understand the emotional faculties of adversaries and not just neutralize the current rational incentives. The best-laid plans of peacemakers are often derailed by the adversary's ethnocentrism, sense of honor, moralization, and self-deception. These mindsets evolved to deal with hostilities in the ancestral past, and we must bring them into the open if we are to work around them in the present. An emphasis on the open-endedness of human rationality resonates with the finding from cognitive science that the mind is a combinatorial, recursive system. Not only do we have thoughts, but we have thoughts about our thoughts, and thoughts about our thoughts about our thoughts. The advances in human conflict resolution we have encountered in this chapter, submitting to the rule of law, figuring out a way for both sides to back down without losing face, acknowledging the possibility of one's own self-deception, accepting the equivalence of one's own interests and other people's, depend on this ability. Many intellectuals have averted their gaze from the evolutionary logic of violence, fearing that acknowledging it is tantamount to accepting it or even to approving it. Instead, they have pursued the comforting delusion of the noble savage, in which violence is an arbitrary product of learning, or a pathogen that bores into us from the outside. But denying the logic of violence makes it easy to forget how readily violence can flare up, and ignoring the parts of the mind that ignite violence makes it easy to overlook the parts that can extinguish it. With violence, as with so many other concerns, human nature is the problem, but human nature is also the solution. Chapter 18. Gender. Now that its namesake year has come and gone, the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, provides an opportunity to measure imagination against reality. Arthur C. Clarke's 1968 sci-fi classic traced out the destiny of our species from ape men on the savannah to a transcendence of time, space, and bodies that we can only dimly comprehend. Clarke and the director, Stanley Kubrick, contrived a radical vision of life in the third millennium, and in some ways it has come to pass. A permanent space station is being built, and voicemail and the Internet are a routine part of our lives. In other regards, Clark and Kubrick were over-optimistic about the march of progress. We still don't have suspended animation, missions to Jupiter, or computers that read lips and plot mutinies. And in still other regards, they missed the boat completely. In their vision of the year 2001, people recorded their words on typewriters. Clark and Kubrick did not anticipate word processors or laptop computers. And in their depiction of the new millennium, the American women were girl assistants, secretaries, receptionists, and flight attendants. That these visionaries did not anticipate the revolution in women's status of the 1970s is a pointed reminder of how quickly social arrangements can change. It was not so long ago that women were seen as fit only to be housewives, mothers, and sexual partners, were discouraged from entering the professions because they would be taking the place of a man, and were routinely subject to discrimination, condescension, and sexual extortion. The ongoing liberation of women after millennia of oppression is one of the great moral achievements of our species, and I consider myself fortunate to have lived through some of its major victories. The change in the status of women has several causes. One is the inexorable logic of the expanding moral circle, which led also to the abolition of despotism, slavery, feudalism, and racial segregation. In the midst of the Enlightenment, the early feminist Mary Astell, 1688-1731, wrote, "If absolute sovereignty be not necessary in a state, how comes it to be so in a family? Or if in a family, why not in a state? Since no reason can be alleged for the one that will not hold more strongly for the other. If all men are born free, how is it that all women are born slaves? As they must be, if the being subjected to the inconstant, uncertain, unknown, arbitrary will of men be the perfect condition of slavery." Another cause is the technological and economic progress that made it possible for couples to have sex and raise children without a pitiless division of labor, in which a mother had to devote every waking moment to keeping the children alive. Clean water, sanitation, and modern medicine lowered infant mortality and reduced the desire for large broods of children. Baby bottles and pasteurized cow's milk, and then breast pumps and freezers, made it possible to feed babies without their mothers being chained to them around the clock. Mass production made it cheaper to buy things than to make them by hand, and plumbing, electricity, and appliances reduced the domestic workload even more. The increased value of brains over brawn in the economy, the extension of the human lifespan, with the prospect of decades of life after child-rearing, and the affordability of extended education changed the values of women's options in life. Contraception, amniocentesis, ultrasound, and reproductive technologies made it possible for women to defer childbearing to the optimal points in their lives. And of course, the other major cause of women's progress is feminism. The political, literary, and academic movements that channeled these advances into tangible changes in policies and attitudes. The first wave of feminism, bookended in the United States by the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848 and the ratification of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution in 1920, gave women the right to vote, to serve as jurors, to hold property in marriage, to divorce, and to receive an education. The second wave, flowering in the 1970s, brought women into the professions, changed the division of labor in the home, exposed sexist biases in business, government, and other institutions, and threw a spotlight on women's interests in all walks of life. The recent progress in women's rights has not drained feminism of its raison d'etre. In much of the Third World, women's position has not improved since the Middle Ages, and in our own society, women are still subjected to discrimination, harassment, and violence. Feminism is widely seen as being opposed to the sciences of human nature. Many of those scientists believe that the minds of the two sexes differ at birth. And feminists have pointed out that such beliefs have long been used to justify the unequal treatment of women. Women were thought to be designed for child-rearing and home life, and to be incapable of the reason necessary for politics and the professions. Men were believed to harbor irresistible urges that made them harass and rape women, and that belief served to excuse the perpetrators and to license fathers and husbands to control women in the guise of protecting them. Therefore, it might seem, the theories that are most friendly to women are the blank slate. If nothing is innate, differences between the sexes cannot be innate. And the noble savage. If we harbor no ignoble urges, sexual exploitation can be eliminated by changing our institutions. The belief that feminism requires a blank slate and a noble savage has become a powerful impetus for spreading disinformation. A 1994 headline in the New York Times Science section, for example, proclaimed, "Sex is equal on South Sea Isle." It was based on the work of the anthropologist Maria Lepowski, who, perhaps channeling the ghost of Margaret Mead, said that gender relations on the island of Vanatinai prove that the subjugation of women by men is not a human universal, and it is not inevitable. Only late in the story do we learn what this supposed equality amounts to. That men must do bride service to pay for wives. That warfare had been waged exclusively by men, who raided neighboring islands for brides. That women spend more time caring for children and sweeping up pig excrement. And that men spend more time building their reputations and hunting wild boar, which is accorded more prestige by both sexes. A similar disconnect between headline and fact appeared in a 1998 Boston Globe story entitled, "Girls Appear to be Closing Aggression Gap with Boys." How much have they closed this gap? According to the story, they now commit murder at one-tenth the rate of boys. And in a 1998 op-ed, the co-producer of Ms. Magazine's Take Our Daughters to Work Day explained recent high school shootings with the remarkable assertion that boys in America are being trained by their parents, other adults, and our culture and media to harass, assault, rape, and murder girls. On the other side, some conservatives are confirming feminists' worst fears by invoking dubious sex differences to condemn the choices of women. In a Wall Street Journal editorial, the political scientist Harvey Mansfield wrote that the protective element of manliness is endangered by women having equal access to jobs outside the home. A book by F. Carolyn Gralia, called Domestic Tranquility, A Brief Against Feminism, theorized that women's maternal and sexual instincts are being distorted by the assertiveness and analytical mind demanded by a career. The journalists Wendy Shallet and Danielle Crittenden recently advised women to marry young, postpone their careers, and care for children in traditional marriages, even though they could not have written their books if they had followed their own advice. Leon Cass has taken it upon himself to inform young women what they want. For the first time in human history, mature women by the tens of thousands live the entire decade of their 20s, their most fertile years, neither in the homes of their fathers nor in the homes of their husbands. Unprotected, lonely, and out of sync with their inborn nature. Some women positively welcome this state of affairs, but most do not. There is, in fact, no incompatibility between the principles of feminism and the possibility that men and women are not psychologically identical. To repeat, equality is not the empirical claim that all groups of humans are interchangeable. It is the moral principle that individuals should not be judged or constrained by the average properties of their group. In the case of gender, the barely defeated Equal Rights Amendment put it succinctly. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. If we recognize this principle, no one has to spin myths about the indistinguishability of the sexes to justify equality, nor should anyone invoke sex differences to justify discriminatory policies or to hector women into doing what they don't want to do. In any case, what we do know about the sexes does not call for any action that would penalize or constrain one sex or the other. Many psychological traits relevant to the public sphere, such as general intelligence, are the same on average for men and women, and virtually all psychological traits may be found in varying degrees among the members of each sex. No sex difference yet discovered applies to every last man compared with every last woman, so generalizations about a sex will always be untrue of many individuals. And notions like proper role and natural place are scientifically meaningless and give no grounds for restricting freedom. Despite these principles, many feminists vehemently attack research on sexuality and sex differences. The politics of gender is a major reason that the application of evolution, genetics, and neuroscience to the human mind is bitterly resisted in modern intellectual life. But unlike other human divisions, such as race and ethnicity, where any biological differences are minor at most and scientifically uninteresting, gender cannot possibly be ignored in the science of human beings. The sexes are as old as complex life, and are a fundamental topic in evolutionary biology, genetics, and behavioral ecology. To disregard them in the case of our own species would be to make a hash of our understanding of our place in the cosmos. And of course differences between men and women affect every aspect of our lives. We all have a mother and a father, are attracted to members of the opposite sex, or notice our contrast with the people who are, and are never unaware of the sex of our siblings, children, and friends. To ignore gender would be to ignore a major part of the human condition. The goal of this chapter is to clarify the relation between the biology of human nature and current controversies on the sexes, including the two most incendiary, the gender gap and sexual assault. With both of these hot buttons, I will argue against the conventional wisdom associated with certain people who claim to speak on behalf of feminism. That may create an illusion that the arguments go against feminism in general, or even against the interests of women. They don't in the least, and I must begin by showing why. Feminism is often derided because of the arguments of its lunatic fringe. For example, that all intercourse is rape, that all women should be lesbians, or that only 10% of the population should be allowed to be male. Feminists reply that proponents of women's rights do not speak with one voice, and that feminist thought comprises many positions which have to be evaluated independently. That is completely legitimate, but it cuts both ways. To criticize a particular feminist proposal is not to attack feminism in general. Anyone familiar with academia knows that it breeds ideological cults that are prone to dogma and resistant to criticism. Many women believe that this has now happened to feminism. In her book, Who Stole Feminism?, the philosopher Christina Hoff Sommers draws a useful distinction between two schools of thought. Equity feminism opposes sex discrimination and other forms of unfairness to women. It is part of the classical liberal and humanistic tradition that grew out of the Enlightenment, and it guided the first wave of feminism and launched the second wave. Gender feminism holds that women continue to be enslaved by a pervasive system of male dominance, the gender system, in which bisexual infants are transformed into male and female gender personalities, the one destined to command, the other to obey. It is opposed to the classical liberal tradition and allied instead with Marxism, postmodernism, social constructionism, and radical science. It has become the credo of some women's studies programs, feminist organizations, and spokespeople for the women's movement. Equity feminism is a moral doctrine about equal treatment that makes no commitments regarding open empirical issues in psychology or biology. Gender feminism is an empirical doctrine committed to three claims about human nature. The first is that the differences between men and women have nothing to do with biology, but are socially constructed in their entirety. The second is that humans possess a single social motive, power, and that social life can be understood only in terms of how it is exercised. The third is that human interactions arise not from the motives of people dealing with each other as individuals, but from the motives of groups dealing with other groups. In this case, the male gender dominating the female gender. In embracing these doctrines, the genderists are handcuffing feminism to railroad tracks on which a train is bearing down. As we shall see, neuroscience, genetics, psychology, and ethnography are documenting sex differences that almost certainly originate in human biology. and evolutionary psychology is documenting a web of motives other than group against group dominance, such as love, sex, family, and beauty, that entangle us in many conflicts and confluences of interest with members of the same sex and of the opposite sex. Gender feminists want either to derail the train or to have other women join them in martyrdom. But the other women are not cooperating. Despite their visibility, gender feminists do not speak for all feminists, let alone for all women. To begin with, research on the biological basis of sex differences has been led by women. Because it is so often said that this research is a plot to keep women down, I will have to name names. Researchers on the biology of sex differences include the neuroscientists Raquel Gurr, Melissa Hines, Doreen Kimura, Jerry Levy, Martha McClintock, Sally Shaywitz, and Sandra Whittleson, and the psychologists Kamala Benbow, Linda Gottfriedson, Diane Halpern, Judith Kleinfeld, and Diane McGuinness. Sociobiology and evolutionary psychology, sometimes stereotyped as a sexist discipline, is perhaps the most bi-gendered academic field I am familiar with. Its major figures include Laura Betzig, Elizabeth Cashton, Lida Cosmides, Helena Cronin, Mildred Dickerman, Helen Fisher, Patricia Gawati, Kristen Hawkes, Sarah Blaffer Hurdy, Magdalena Hurtado, Bobby Lowe, Linda Mealy, Felicia Prato, Marnie Rice, Catherine Salmon, Joan Silk, Meredith Small, Barbara Smuts, Nancy Wilmson Thornhill, and Margot Wilson. It is not just gender feminism's collision with science that repels many feminists. Like other inbred ideologies, it has produced strange excrescences, like the offshoot known as difference feminism. Carol Gilligan has become a gender feminist icon because of her claim that men and women guide their moral reasoning by different principles. Men think about rights and justice. Women have feelings of compassion, nurturing, and peaceful accommodation. If true, it would disqualify women from becoming constitutional lawyers, Supreme Court justices, and moral philosophers who make their living by reasoning about rights and justice. But it is not true. Many studies have tested Gilligan's hypothesis and found that men and women differ little or not at all in their moral reasoning. So difference feminism offers women the worst of both worlds, invidious claims without scientific support. Similarly, the gender feminist classic called Women's Ways of Knowing claims that the sexes differ in their styles of reasoning. Men value excellence and mastery in intellectual matters and skeptically evaluate arguments in terms of logic and evidence. Women are spiritual, relational, inclusive, and credulous. With sisters like these, who needs male chauvinists? Gender feminism's disdain for analytical rigor and classical liberal principles has recently been excoriated by equity feminists, among them Jean Bethke Elchdain, Elizabeth Fox Genovese, Wendy Kaminer, Noretta Kurtke, Donna LaFramboise, Mary Lefkowitz, Wendy McElroy, Camille Paglia, Daphne Patai, Virginia Postrel, Alice Rossi, Sally Satel, Christina Hoff Summers, Nadine Strawson, Joan Kennedy Taylor, and Kathy Young. Well before them, prominent women writers demurred from gender feminist ideology, including Joan Didion, Doris Lessing, Iris Murdoch, Cynthia Ozick, and Susan Sontag. And ominously for the movement, a younger generation has rejected the gender feminists' claim that love, beauty, flirtation, erotica, art, and heterosexuality are pernicious social constructs. The title of the book, The New Victorians, A Young Women's Challenge to the Old Feminist Order, captures the revolt of such writers as Renee Denfeld, Karen Lehrman, Katie Reuf, and Rebecca Walker, and of the movements called Third Wave, Riot Girl Movement, Pro-Sex Feminism, Lipstick Lesbians, Girl Power, and Feminists for Free Expression. The difference between gender feminism and equity feminism accounts for the oft-reported paradox that most women do not consider themselves feminists. About 70% in 1997, up from about 60% a decade before. Yet they agree with every major feminist position. The explanation is simple. The word feminist is often associated with gender feminism, but the positions in the polls are those of equity feminism. Faced with these signs of slipping support, gender feminists have tried to stipulate that only they can be considered the true advocates of women's rights. For example, in 1992, Gloria Steinem said of Polya, "Her calling herself a feminist is sort of like a Nazi saying they're not anti-Semitic." And they have invented a lexicon of epithets for what in any other area would be called disagreement. Backlash, not getting it, silencing women, intellectual harassment. All this is an essential background to the discussions to come. To say that women and men do not have interchangeable minds, that people have desires other than power, and that motives belong to individual people and not just to entire genders, is not to attack feminism or to compromise the interests of women, despite the misconception that gender feminism speaks in their name. All the arguments in the remainder of this chapter have been advanced most forcefully by women. Why are people so afraid of the idea that the minds of men and women are not identical in every respect? Would we really be better off if everyone were like Pat, the androgynous nerd from Saturday Night Live? The fear, of course, is that different implies unequal, that if the sexes differed in any way, then men would have to be better or more dominant or have all the fun. Nothing could be farther from biological thinking. Trivers alluded to a symmetry in human relationships, which embraced a genetic equality of the sexes. From a gene's point of view, being in the body of a male and being in the body of a female are equally good strategies, at least on average. Circumstances can nudge the advantage somewhat in either direction. Natural selection thus tends toward an equal investment in the two sexes. Equal numbers, an equal complexity of bodies and brains, and equally effective designs for survival. Is it better to be the size of a male baboon and have 6-inch canine teeth, or to be the size of a female baboon and not have them? Merely to ask the question is to reveal its pointlessness. A biologist would say that it's better to have the male adaptations to deal with male problems and the female adaptations to deal with female problems. So men are not from Mars, nor are women from Venus. Men and women are from Africa, the cradle of our evolution, where they evolved together as a single species. Men and women have all the same genes except for a handful on the Y chromosome, and their brains are so similar that it takes an eagle-eyed neuroanatomist to find the small differences between them. Their average levels of general intelligence are the same, according to the best psychometric estimates. And they use language and think about the physical and living world in the same general way. They feel the same basic emotions, and both enjoy sex, seek intelligent and kind marriage partners, get jealous, make sacrifices for their children, compete for status and mates, and sometimes commit aggression in pursuit of their interests. But of course the minds of men and women are not identical, and recent reviews of sex differences have converged on some reliable differences. Sometimes the differences are large, with only slight overlap in the bell curves. Men have a stronger taste for no-string sex with multiple or anonymous partners, as we see in the almost all-male consumer base for prostitution and visual pornography. Men are far more likely to compete violently, sometimes lethally, with one another over stakes great and small, as in the recent case of a surgeon and an anesthesiologist who came to blows in the operating room while a patient lay on the table waiting to have her gallbladder removed. Among children, boys spend far more time practicing for violent conflict in the form of what psychologists genteelly called rough-and-tumble play. The ability to manipulate three-dimensional objects and space in the mind also shows a large difference in favor of men. With some other traits, the differences are small on average but can be large at the extremes. That happens for two reasons. When two bell curves partly overlap, the farther out along the tail you go, the larger the discrepancies between the groups. For example, men on average are taller than women, and the discrepancy is greater for more extreme values. At a height of 5'10", men outnumber women by a ratio of 30-1. At a height of 6 feet, men outnumber women by a ratio of 2,000 to 1. Also, confirming an expectation from evolutionary psychology, for many traits the bell curve for males is flatter and wider than the curve for females. That is, there are proportionately more males at the extremes. Along the left tail of the curve, one finds that boys are far more likely to be dyslexic, learning disabled, attention deficient, emotionally disturbed, and mentally retarded, at least for some types of retardation. At the right tail, one finds that in a sample of talented students who score above 700 out of 800 on the mathematics section of the scholastic assessment tests, boys outnumber girls by 13 to 1, even though the scores of boys and girls are similar within the bulk of the curve. With still other traits, the average values for the two sexes differ by smaller amounts and in different directions for different traits. Though men, on average, are better at mentally rotating objects and maps, women are better at remembering landmarks and the positions of objects. Men are better throwers, women are more dexterous. Men are better at solving mathematical word problems, women at mathematical calculation. Women are more sensitive to sounds and smells, have better depth perception, match shapes faster, and are much better at reading facial expressions and body language. Women are better spellers, retrieve words more fluently, and have a better memory for verbal material. Women experience basic emotions more intensely, except perhaps anger. Women have more intimate social relationships, are more concerned about them, and feel more empathy toward their friends, though not toward strangers. The common view that women are more empathetic toward everyone is both evolutionarily unlikely and untrue. They maintain more eye contact and smile and laugh far more often. Men are more likely to compete with one another for status using violence or occupational achievement. Women more likely to use derogation and other forms of verbal aggression. Men have a higher tolerance for pain and a greater willingness to risk life and limb for status, attention, and other dubious rewards. The Darwin Awards, given annually to the individuals who ensure the long-term survival of our species by removing themselves from the gene pool in a sublimely idiotic fashion, almost always go to men. Recent honorees include the man who squashed himself under a Coke machine after tipping it forward to get a free can. Three men who competed over who could stomp the hardest on an anti-tank mine, and the would-be pilot who tied weather balloons to his lawn chair, shot 2 miles into the air, and drifted out to sea, earning just an honorable mention because he was rescued by helicopter. Women are more attentive to their infants' everyday cries, though both sexes respond equally to cries of extreme distress, and are more solicitous toward their children in general. Girls play more at parenting and trying on social roles, boys more at fighting, chasing, and manipulating objects. And men and women differ in their patterns of sexual jealousy, their mate preferences, and their incentives to philander. Many sex differences, of course, have nothing to do with biology. Hairstyles and dress vary capriciously across centuries and cultures, and in recent decades, participation in universities, professions, and sports has switched from mostly male to 50-50 or mostly female. For all we know, some of the current sex differences may be just as ephemeral. But gender feminists argue that all sex differences, other than the anatomical ones, come from the expectations of parents, playmates, and society. The radical scientist Anne Fausto Sterling wrote, "The key biological fact is that boys and girls have different genitalia, and it is this biological difference that leads adults to interact differently with different babies, whom we conveniently color-code in pink or blue to make it unnecessary to go peering into their diapers for information about gender." But the pink and blue theory is becoming less and less credible. Here are a dozen kinds of evidence that suggest that the difference between men and women is more than genitalia deep. Sex differences are not an arbitrary feature of Western culture, like the decision to drive on the left or on the right. In all human cultures, men and women are seen as having different natures. All cultures divide their labor by sex, with more responsibility for child-rearing by women, and more control of the public and political realms by men. The division of labor emerged even in a culture where everyone had been committed to stamping it out, the Israeli kibbutz. In all cultures, men are more aggressive, more prone to stealing, more prone to lethal violence, including war, and more likely to woo, seduce, and trade favors for sex. And in all